Welcome back to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host, Jason Rugg, back from an extended sick leave. Actually, I was only sick for a week, but you recorded two episodes that week, so I've been gone for like a month for all the listeners. I apologize. I didn't ditch Christian, I just got sick.
Well, and not only did you get sick, you had to take care of your grandmother, too. You were being a dutiful grandson, so you did have a bunch of stuff going on, but it's so nice to have you back. So great to see you.
Have I been gone like 6 weeks for...
I think you've been gone like since before Thanksgiving. Anyway,
I totally forgot about that. Oh my gosh, yeah, it's been
nice
a long time
to have you back.
I'm glad to be back, and I'm here with Christian Taylor.
Thank you very much. So happy to be here. It's I really love our times together, and I really hope you listeners out there are enjoying our podcast. We had a lot of changes this year. This is really our last recording for the year, and I wanted to do a little updating of and like a year in review sort of as we've looked over 2023 and kind of closing everything out. This year was a big change for us. We really left from it being a filmmaker journey, my journey of making The Girl Who Wore Freedom and, you know, journeying into independent filmmaking, to more of spreading our wings, looking at more filmmakers that are out there in the world doing their own documentary films. And it is just opened our world tremendously. We've talked to people like Ken Burns and a whole host of filmmakers and, you know, composers and sound mixers and, you know, cinematographers. I mean, it's just been amazing, the people that we've talked to. So if you have missed any of our podcasts in 2023, I would say go back and look at all the different subjects we covered and the people that we talked to, and just dive in, because we learned a whole lot this year. And we've grown. We've also grown in our Patreon support. So I want to talk a little bit about Patreon. We now have, I think, 132 Patreon supporters. And I just want to say thank you so much to everybody that has joined. It's just been an incredible blessing, especially in the last 2 months. Not only have we had people join, but they've increased their membership donation. And I want to give a shout out to a few of these people that just continue to blow my mind by their support. Number one on the list is James Heiberger. James has been supporting us for a very long time, not only financially, but also with his advice and his input about things we should do or cover or even not do. And he just has been instrumental to supporting and encouraging and creative input as well. So James, I just want to say thank you so much. It just is a tremendous blessing to have you as our top Patreon supporter. Travis Rabb has come in right behind him. He is a new supporter this year. He also is a supporter of my family. He reached out to us. He's a former military member, and he's kind of been encouraging my son in his helicopter pilot journey. So Travis, I want to say thank you. You've been an incredible blessing. Jenna and Jeff Kurtenacker, these Patreon supporters blow my mind, because many of you will know that Jeff is our composer for The Girl Who Wore Freedom. He's also going to be composing Heroes of Carentan. And yet they continue to support us on Patreon because they believe in the work that we're doing here. Benjamin Smith, Janie and Bob Miller, Mayanda Winarski is a new supporter since November 2nd. Brian Mullins, Gail Gilbert, who herself is a filmmaker and has been a guest on this podcast, has also been supporting us. Jody Black, Josh Sharp, who we're going to hear a little bit more about in the future, Judith Nolan, Catherine Paris, Lindsay Vasant, the list goes on. And we are going to name some more of those supporters later, give them all a shout out. The thing I love, Jason, about these Patreon supporters is our Patreon has also changed. It's not just people that kind of come there, support with their donations, and get a few perks. The way that we're engaging with our Patreon supporters now, they've become kind of a core creative team. We're reaching out to them and asking them their thoughts and their ideas, suggestions, and figuring out how to partner with us in the new stuff that we're doing. The most recent example of that is that we had a Zoom party on December 7th. We had a handful of people, I would say like 10 people, join us and talk about what they want to see this podcast become, what they would like to see inside the Patreon world. And it was just fun, encouraging. And I just want to say, if you've ever thought about supporting us on Patreon, now is the time. 2024 is going to be super exciting, not only on the documentary podcast, but also in the Patreon world and our film world. And that brings me to The Girl Who Wore Freedom and Heroes of Carentan. I want to give a quick update about those. The Girl Who Wore Freedom has some exciting news, Jason. I haven't told you this. You've been away too long.
I'm so excited to hear. I couldn't tell you the last time we had like a big update about The Girl Who Wore Freedom. It's been a while, so I'm really excited about this.
All right, so here we go. Most people will know that this year it's been on Amazon, Vudu, Apple TV, several other streaming places. It's been in Hoopla, and you can find it at your library on Hoopla. It's now about to have a deal. We've already agreed to a deal. I haven't signed the paper yet, but with Canal Plus, which is the biggest streaming TV channel in the French-speaking world. So this just is mind-blowing to me that finally people in France are going to be able to see this film in their own language. And I will let everybody know when that deal is inked, but it looks like we're close to signing that right in the new year, and it will be ready for distribution in the 80th anniversary year of D-Day. So woohoo, that's a super exciting news. For this coming year. So I'm super happy about that. It is still on DVD. We are continuing to sell DVDs on our website. You can stream on our website as well as all the other streaming platforms I just mentioned. And we are making a big push to find new venues to show the film, theater venues or with organizations in 2024. So, things are looking up for The Girl Who Wore Freedom. The last thing that's super exciting, I think we will finally see some revenue for The Girl Who Wore Freedom through distribution in 2024. We've now gone a year of distribution. I think we've basically broken even with paying back our distribution costs. And I am expecting to see something. It may only be $10, but I do think that we'll be in the black. Coming up in 2024 with the film. So that's
a huge milestone. I mean, so many films never even get close to that. And so to actually be in a place where we're talking about it, it could happen. It looks like it's likely to happen. That is absolutely incredible, Christian. Congratulations.
Especially during this hard COVID, like tumultuous distribution, you know, seismic shift.
The streaming implosion and everything.
Film festivals not happening, et cetera, et cetera. So, there's been a big change. So that's super. The other new thing is that there has been a shift over at Netflix. And so there's a new buyer there and a potential of maybe us pitching to this new buyer. So that's now an option. I think our distributor, Virgil Films, is talking with American Public Television. So there just seems to be a lot of things cooking for 2024. And hopefully there will be more updates in the future. So that's about The Girl Who Wore Freedom. I'm going to jump into Heroes of Carentan. What was the last thing you remember me saying about Heroes of Carentan, Jason?
I remember there was an update about something was going on with the script, whether or not it was like you had really like were you close to a first draft or something like that? Like there were some pieces there I remember, but it's been a while since I've heard an update about that too.
Right. So Heroes of Carentan is our new documentary. It looks at the heroes who liberated the town of Carentan in 1944, which is a small town in France, a critical battle during World War II. And these guys were critical to this liberation war effort. And nobody knows about them. Nobody knows about the town. And so we really want people to learn more about them because they have inspired our current modern day soldiers who now are fighting on the border of Ukraine. So we've talked to these currently serving soldiers that just returned from serving on the border of Ukraine about how these heroes in 1944 have inspired them, the things they have learned. They share about their own military experiences and how combat has affected them and their families. It's a really, really powerful story, and I'm so excited for what this documentary is going to become. We have now written our logline and our synopsis. We have filmed everything we're going to film. We are definitely in the post-production phase. We're making our pitch deck and about to start raising funds. I think we're aiming to raise about $200,000 in 2024, which is a huge goal. But we're going to get that ball rolling somewhere probably in February. So that's where we are. We've got Bill Ebel has already started working on that, and he's excited to get the trailer going. So things are cooking, Jason.
Awesome. That's so exciting.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, I feel like we've had some just awesome news already this podcast. This is a very happy, good podcast. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, and we have even more news to come. We have a special guest.
Yes, we do. Should we roll into Josh's introduction?
Let's do it.
All right. So allow me to introduce you all to Josh Sharp. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Excited to have you here. Josh Sharp is a Pacific Northwest-based entertainment journalist with bylines in Collider, Theater Mania, and the Diz Insider. Crafting and discussing captivating narratives around the subject of film has been the driving force behind his career journey. He was formerly the head writer at Diz Insider, interviewing creatives like Haley Mills, Leonard Maltin, and Jody Benson. Currently, he primarily contributes to Theater Mania, where his focus is about musical theater on screen and stage. Happy to have you here, Josh.
Thank you, Jason. Happy to be here.
Yeah.
It's super nice to meet you. We did forget one important thing in your resume there, and that is that you are a Patreon supporter, and that is how I learned about you in the first place. So thank you very much for supporting us on Patreon. I don't know how you ended up here. Why don't you tell us, how you ended up supporting us and how we all became friends?
Yeah, well, thanks, Christian. I've been a Holy Post listener for many years, probably 5 or 6 at least. And so that's kind of how I got to know you, Christian, just as a listener. And then Jason, especially during the pandemic, I was very active on Twitter with movie stuff, and I was doing a lot of interviews and that sort of thing. And so I think Jason and I found each other there because of Jason's love for animation. And I think I also started, I think I one time sent him a picture of a cinnamon roll too, which was very fun. I think we had a little debate because I had ordered a cinnamon roll with butter, which Jason thought was very strange. Because because at this local place that I go to for cinnamon rolls, they serve it with butter and it's like the best thing. And Jason was very disturbed by that at first.
I've seen pecan rolls with butter on them. That makes sense to me. But a cinnamon roll has icing, not, I don't know. It's
and butter. well sometimes.
Yes. There is already butter in a cinnamon roll and you're adding extra butter is what you're saying.
Look, fat is flavor.
You butter fat. A piece of bread.
Yeah. I mean I get it. I get it. It probably just makes it even more flavorful, but I don't know. It struck me weird.
No, it is probably weird. Anyway,
and I do think people need to know that Jason has a cinnamon roll thing. And if you follow Jason on Twitter, which is at Jace Ruggie, you will learn that Jason and cinnamon rolls go hand in hand.
I found the tweet from 2021. butter on the side. It has icing and then a little cup of butter on the side. That's just...
Oh. That's how they serve it. But
okay.
Yes, I could see how that would be maybe strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, that's how I got to know Jason. That's how I got to know Christian. And so it's been really great to also be able to join Patreon. Yes. For Documentary First and be part of that community.
Yeah. So it's since Jason kind of came on board and we've opened up Patreon to be more a collaborative and intimate space, I was able to talk to you, figure out that you do review films and you've met a lot of really interesting people. And for me, reviews for The Girl Who Wore Freedom were incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And I wanted our filmmakers out there to learn a little bit more about critic reviews and about why they are important and how we should think about them. So first of all, why don't you jump in and just give us a little bit about your background and how you got started in the film critic review interview field?
Yeah, well, I don't want to be too anecdotal about my background, but I would say it really started with my grandpa, actually. As a kid, he, this was in the day when everybody had an extensive home physical media collection, and he had so many movies and I would stare at them for hours and I would take them off the shelf and I would read the back. And so his interest in movies kind of put, like, it planted a seed in me for my own interest in movies. So that was part of it. And then the other thing was he had this book called Leonard Maltin's Movie Guide. And had, and I don't know if you're familiar with Leonard Maltin, but he's a, he yeah. used to be on Entertainment Tonight, and he used to kind of be a broadcasting their film critic. But he also published this book every single year before the internet, and it would include like these teeny little, like maybe 4 sentence or 3 sentence reviews about movies. And every year they would come out with a new edition, which would add the movies that had been released the previous year. And also the nerd in me loved all the, like the listing of all of the actors, the running time, whether it was in color or black and white, all these things. So, I would carry my, I remember getting my own copy for the first time, and I would carry that around, and I would just like thumb through it. I would take it to events, and I would, like, rather than interacting with the people around me, like most people do at parties or whatever, I would be looking through this movie guide. And so I think that's where my interest in film really started. And then without really knowing about film criticism, but just knowing that this guy whose face was on this book was being paid to write about movies, that seemed like a really exciting thing, and something that growing up in a rural place in the Pacific Northwest seemed like a foreign, like, kind of world to me, like nothing that I, yeah, it's not something that I saw very much of. So that was the, when I was really, really young. In terms of, I'll fast forward some years. When I was in high school, I started writing about movies. I started a film blog, which is still out there, but I'm not going to say the name of it because it's, I went back and I read some of my reviews, and it's, they're not good, quite frankly. So, but if you really want to find them, maybe you might be able to. So I was just, that was just something I was like, oh, I am a teen writing my own film review blog. That must be interesting for people who want a teen's point of view on the film industry. Most of the people that read it were my, you know, moms and things like that, like my friends' moms, and, you know, but anyway, I felt pretty cool. And then after that, I started writing a few years later about Disney. I kind of got into this like Disney mode where I was really fascinated by animation. I was kind of went back and watched some of the old animated movies, and becoming really fascinated with Disney history. And that's when I got in contact with a guy named Skylar Schuler, who had just started a website called Disney Film Facts. Which is basically what it sounded like. Like, he would post facts about Disney movies. But it sort of became, it was sort of moving in the direction of more of a news website. So rather than, like, you know, Cinderella was out, came out this day in 1950, it was like, what does the current movie world look like? And so from that point, I started writing for him. I would do a lot of history pieces. I would do a lot of, I did some review pieces, a lot of, yeah, retrospective kind of stuff was really mostly what I did. And then the pandemic hit, and he asked me to interview people. So as things were coming out, of course, word of mouth, you know, you want things to be marketed. You want people to know about what you're making. And this is true whether you're Disney or whether you're a small independent company. So I started interviewing people there. And then from that point, I became sort of a freelance critic. So that means I can, I pitch something to a website, whether it's a review or a history piece. And then they can tell me whether they're interested or not. And then if they are interested, then I either go to the movie, or I've also reviewed plays, or I will then set up interviews with people that I might want to talk to about whatever it is I'm writing about.
Well, I'm going to pitch something for you to pitch. And that is, would you please write a review of The Girl Who Wore Freedom? So, and then go pitch it to someone. That would be amazing.
I'd love to. Absolutely.
Yeah. I asked you earlier if you had watched it, and what did you tell me?
I said, no, I haven't watched it yet.
So see, it's a perfect time. You can watch the film, write a review just in time for the 80th anniversary of D-Day.
Yes. Perfect timing.
Excellent. Well, now, you said you started your love of films through these books by Leonard Maltin, and I do remember him. He's sort of a Roger Ebert, you know, character, just in a different channel.
They were contemporaries,
and
for sure.
They were, and it was my era, I do have to say. So I remember him well. Now, did I read that you actually interviewed him?
Yes. So this was a very full circle moment and quite surreal for me. This was in 2020. I was quite, I had just sort of gotten started. I wasn't super established and I wasn't super confident, to be quite honest, in this. And, I had met him at a D23 event the year before, briefly. So we'd met and I talked to him a little bit. And then I had gotten to know his daughter through Twitter. Her name is Jessie Malton, and they do a podcast actually called Malton on Movies, where they interview creatives. So they interview composers, they interview actors, directors, people involved with the film industry.
So he's still going.
He's still going. And so it's he and his daughter, that do it together now. And so it's, and it's a great podcast. It's a great podcast, cause they talk to all,
it kind of sounds similar to ours, but they talk to a lot of other, you know, film. It's not just documentaries.
Right. Yeah. He had, recently he had, I think maybe this was last year, I don't know, but he had Martin Short on. He talked to people like, Tim Burton, Angela Lansbury before she passed away. So really high profile people. And during the pandemic, there wasn't a lot of going to the movies and doing, you know, that kind of thing. And so anyway, I ended up getting a hold of Jessie Malton and then, by extension, her dad. And so we had a phone interview where he talked to me about his start in Disney, because I had known him as a kid, like I said, the face on this book. And I know he had been on TV, but really that was just this book. But he actually had been, he's a huge Disney buff. And he wrote one of the first big books on Disney back in, this would have been, I think, the 70s, called the Disney Films. And he talked to me about that process and what that was like. When he was in, I think he must have been in high school when Walt Disney died, and he was publishing what was then called a fanzine, which is kind of like a blog now, but he would, you know, it was on paper and they would send them out to the people that were subscribers. And he, when Walt Disney passed away, he realized he wanted to do a whole issue about Walt Disney. So he contacted, and this is when you could just like call up Walt Disney Studios and there'd be like a receptionist that would answer and talk to you and answer questions about things.
Oh, those were the days.
Right. Not quite the way it works now. But so he called Disney Studios and said, I'm interested in getting a list of all the films that Disney had made. And this was before the days of like archivists. Like they had an archivist there at the studio for many, many years, but this, I guess, predates that. And I think there was like, there hadn't really been a list like written down, like the way that we think about now, like now you can go to Wikipedia or whatever. And like, okay, what is every film that Disney has ever made? Like you can find that really easily. But back then it wasn't something that was just available for everybody that had been written down and published somewhere. And so he told me some really interesting stories about, you know, getting to know the people that Walt Disney worked with, being invited to the studio, interviewing directors and animators from that era so he could publish eventually. That short little fanzine kind of became a full book several years later. And he really kind of was one of the kind of spearheaded the idea of a Disney historian or somebody that actually chronicles Disney history, which wasn't really a thing at that time.
Wow, imagine that. That's so fascinating. Well, I bet interviewing him was similar to me interviewing Ken Burns. Like I, the whole time was sitting there going, I cannot believe that I am sitting here talking to Ken Burns. Is this really real? Yes. Was that the same for you?
It was the same for me. Absolutely. There were a few people where that was the case. Him being one of them, the second interview I ever did was with Jodie Benson, who's the voice of Ariel.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
So very inexperienced. And she called me. And so she called me on like my personal cell phone and I didn't know, like I had been working with the editor at the site I was writing for about like setting up a time and there wasn't a time set. So she just called me like, she's like, hi, this is Jodie. What are you thinking about? And you know, doing this thing. And I was kind of just like, I don't know. I remember my response was like bizarre. It was like, yes, good, great. Like I was like not expecting that she was going to call me. And my response was completely unnatural. But anyway, cause it was the same thing, like you're saying with Ken Burns, like it was quite, remarkable feeling. And also especially when this is something that you're incredibly passionate about, talking to somebody who works in the field, who's very knowledgeable, and hearing those kind of personal stories and their journey is just so fascinating and inspiring.
What kind of people were they? I mean, when you talked to them, did they meet your expectations? What was Leonard Maltin like? What was Jody Benson like?
I mean, they were incredibly patient and gracious and kind. You know, you think about all the different people that they've probably, like, how many interviews have they probably had throughout the course of their careers? I mean, so many, like, for, you know, from really prominent journalists too. And so they couldn't have been more kind. Which for someone who kind of fell into, I mean, I knew I liked writing about movies, but for someone that fell into this aspect of things, interviewing people and talking to them about it, that was encouraging to know that there's kind people out there that sometimes, you know, we kind of think of these big grandiose public figures in media and stuff, but they were just people and they're kind. Yeah. And they can be kind. And in my experience, they were.
Same with Ken Burns. He just was such a normal human being and just very gracious and kind. So I did not expect anything less.
And what did he tell us that week? That we were like his 64th interview that week?
Yeah, I don't know. It was like 800, something like, you know, 800 over the last 2 weeks, something ridiculous.
Yeah, he had done like every Sirius XM station in 15-minute increments for 4 hours on end.
How exhausting would that be?
I know. And I didn't even have to ask him a question. I mean, he had them already. He could have done the whole show by himself. I didn't have to ask him a thing because he had done it so many times. Well, all right, moving on, talking about interviewing. You know, interviewing is one of the most challenging things that I have ever done. It is a skill to be learned. Flo Plana, who is in The Girl Who Wore Freedom, who interviews World War II veterans, is one of the most impressive interviewers I've ever seen. I, you know, learned so much from him. I think that our documentary filmmakers listening would love to hear some tips and tricks about how to interview people well. What are some keys to interviewing people?
Well, in my experience, there's really two different kinds of interviews. They kind of fall into two broad categories. There's retrospective, and then there's promotional. So if you have someone that's promoting a project, you're probably going to ask them about that project. And that's going to be the focus of your interview. Rather than talking about something that they maybe made 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago, there might be a temptation there to do that because maybe you really want to get some kind of like, so what actually happened in that scenario or whatever, some kind of piece of information. But I think it's important to know the context of the interview. And that's a really great starting point before you generate your list of questions, because they are wanting to promote something that they've made, right? So it's, you're kind of serving them in a way. And I think it's important to keep in mind that it's about them and not about you, the interviewer, which that's something that some, I think, could be easy to learn the hard way that way. And so that's something that's really helpful for me to remember. I would say also making the interviewee feel comfortable. And I think what that looks like is being present. Sometimes there's a temptation to, like I say, write up a list of questions and then stick to it like it's a script, which is a good starting point for sure. Like, be prepared. You want to go in, you want to know what you want to ask them. You want to kind of have a roadmap of what you're doing, but also allow for space in maybe it'll go in a different direction and something that they share will be more interesting than the question that you ask them to begin with. And I think allowing for that space is really important, so that they can, and also just so they can feel comfortable. Like, we kind of live in like a really fast paced society, obviously. And so, and I think when we look at maybe, I don't know, late night shows or whatever, there's a quickness to that. And there's not always room for like thinking and being thoughtful and pausing. And I think, and also with that is like the temptation to just want to fill space. We worry about awkward pauses all the time. And so those awkward pauses are actually where the magic happens sometimes, because that could be them thinking about something that they did a long time ago. And just allowing space for that is really valuable for what you're doing. And it's also valuable for them.
That is such a fantastic point. I watched Flo Plana use that to a T, especially with older people when you're interviewing them. I, as a younger interviewer, would always rush to fill that pause because I didn't want the other person to feel awkward or feel like they were forgetting something. But what I watched him do is always wait one or two, maybe even three beats more, because if you don't fill that space, they will not only have the look of remembering, but typically they add a whole nother level after that pause, and they're willing to open up a little more. So slowing down, not being afraid of that awkward pause is a huge key. I loved what you said before about being prepared. Again, using Flow Planet as an example, if he was going to interview a certain soldier in the Battle of the Bulge in a certain company, he would research to the nth degree about that company and about the members in it and about the different movements that they did. So when he was engaging with that veteran, before you knew it, that veteran felt like they were comrades and that Flo had been there. And so he was talking to him as if he was talking to another battle buddy, which took the interview to a much deeper level. And I think that element of being prepared to meet your subject is critical. And then I want to highlight another thing you said, and that was listening. Listening and being flexible in that interview to go where the conversation takes you is another key point. So those are beautiful tips, I think, that you laid out there for us. Now, you talked about two types of interviews. The first one you said is somebody that wants to promote something. The second one, talk to us a little bit about the second type of interview.
Yes. So most of the interviews, well, I would say maybe half and half, but I feel like a lot of the ones I've done have been retrospective, which are looking back at somebody's career and giving them a chance to think about what they've maybe accomplished and then sharing certain maybe specific stories or aspects of that career with the readers, or if it's like a video with the viewers. There's something that's really nice about retrospective interviews in that, like I said, you're not selling something. So you can explore things that maybe you wouldn't explore otherwise. And if there's also a distance from something, like if there's a painful experience somebody has working on some project, if there's distance from that, they can kind of, they say time heals everything. They can kind of talk about it maybe more openly than they would have when the thing was actually happening or while they were promoting that project, which is really nice. I mean, it's nice to have those moments where you can have that openness and understand where they're coming from. So I really like retrospective interviews just because you can go kind of through the chronology of their career. Or you can also, I mean, it could be broad like that, or it can be really narrowly focused on one thing that they did. So for instance, there's a piece coming out that I've written about the history of Wonka on stage. Because of the new Wonka movie, I wanted to talk to the people that had been involved with like the Broadway productions. And so that's kind of a narrow thing that they did. So that's not like, okay, tell me about this show you wrote and this show you wrote, but it was just, okay, tell me about the experiences writing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory from, 2010 to 2013. And then you can get really interesting tidbits that maybe haven't been shared before, especially because, like I said, that distance, there's a little bit of distance there. And think about maybe, and also give them a chance to think about things they maybe haven't thought about for a while.
Yeah, I love what you said about taking into consideration if something was a difficult moment and they might be reluctant to open up about that. I would say if you know that that's the kind of interview you're about to do as a filmmaker, there are a few things that create that environment for them, a safe space for them, and that is keeping the set as small as possible, keeping your space as intimate as possible. I think lighting helps with that. But bigger than anything, I think that developing the rapport with one another and starting, you know, in the most outlying part of their lives of, you know, tell us about where you're born or joking around about what you had to eat today or, you know, something funny that happened. I mean, you develop that rapport in the beginning of the interview and you slowly get to that place where you feel like they've loosened up and they're ready to be more vulnerable. Creating that space is hugely important, I think, for allowing your subject to feel safe enough to open up. And that's a really critical, important point to get to those really pivotal moments that make a film really special.
Yes, absolutely. And part of that is to just, if you can give as much information to the person you're interviewing ahead of time as possible, I think that's helpful for them.
True.
So that they can go into the interview understanding what it is about, like you're not going to twist their words or I'm using this story for some angle that I want to, you know, highlight that in something I'm doing. But giving them the information right off the bat, whether it's at the beginning of the, like before you start the actual interview, kind of giving them an understanding of what the pieces that you're writing or the film you're making. And the same goes for, you know, or just sending it over email or however you want to do it, but just so that they feel they're part of it. And that way, you know, they know what to expect.
That's beautiful. Beautiful point. Be organized, prepared, give them the questions in advance with enough time, let them know your objectives for the interview. And just, I also love to offer them the opportunity for, you know, first right of refusal, like in, and that's the wrong term, but just giving them the ability to look at it before it's published to say, I don't feel comfortable with this. Because if they know they have that out and they can say, ask you to retract that, I think it gives them the ability to relax and be a little bit more open.
Absolutely. And then also there's sometimes during an interview when, and this would obviously not be a live thing. This would be something that maybe you're having an interview with somebody and then you're going to transcribe it later. And they'll tell you that they'll give you a piece of information that's off the record. And I feel like that's, obviously that's really important to honor because that's what, you know, that's what they're requesting is that you keep this off the record. But also when somebody says offers something and not like you asked, but if somebody offers something like that to you, I think that's a good feeling because it means that they feel comfortable enough with you to share something that maybe they don't want out there, but they are willing to talk to you about it. And I think that sometimes can show that maybe you have established a safe space or made them feel comfortable enough where they are a little bit more open.
And do you think it's permissible to go back to them and say, I know you said that this was off the record, but this was such a beautiful piece of the interview. Would you be open now to sharing it?
I think it depends on what it is, probably. I think, it just depends. Because there's some things that for sure, like if it has to do with other people, it's best to probably keep off the record. Like if it's a negative, if it's going to alter someone's view of somebody else in some way, like if somebody's sharing something about a colleague that they worked with or somebody that they were, maybe made a movie with or whatever, I would probably leave that alone and not push it. But I think there are some things, maybe if they said some kind of, like you said, some kind of really beautiful statement or something that is really, could be really valuable for readers or viewers, then maybe in that context, that would be appropriate. Yeah.
Awesome. Good points. All right. Let's move on to sort of reviews in terms of the relationship with the filmmaker. So when I came out with The Girl Who Wore Freedom, I felt like reviews were so important. Every time I applied for a film festival, they asked for reviews. There were just, when I applied for grants, they asked for reviews. There were so many times where I, you know, got that request. And in the very beginning, I had no reviews and I had no idea how to get a review. And, you know, I was just kind of lost in that world. Talk to me about how this film reviewing process goes.
Well, it's interesting you say that you needed a review to submit your film to festivals, because a lot of times festivals are actually how you get the reviews. Because, you know, journalists will go to things like TIFF or Telluride or Cannes, and they will go see things, and then you know, they might review it, and then that is going to help especially if it's a smaller independent film, or if it's maybe an up and coming filmmaker, that's going to be really huge, because that's the most important thing that you need is that word of mouth and having, people kind of hear about what you're doing, and good word of mouth obviously is the most important. I would say this might be interesting, but I think Twitter is a really good resource for this too. Film Twitter is so active, and there's so many film journalists on Twitter and writers and, filmmakers. I have a cousin who's a screenwriter, and he met his writing partner on Twitter just through networking. And so I would say if you are unable to get reviews at a film festival, and if you don't have maybe a publicist that can help you find people to review your film, that I think, and maybe this isn't the case anymore because Twitter is not even Twitter anymore, but it's, you know, it's X now. But I think this, that it can be a really great way to meet people and connect with people from all over the world who might be interested in seeing your film. Because like I said, so many film journalists on Twitter.
Yeah, I found the first review that I got, which really was, I didn't know how it happened. Now I've kind of traced back and I understand it. But the Utah Film Festival allows an option for you to submit and just ask for a review. And, you know, one day this review kind of showed up somewhere. And it was a review for The Girl Who Wore Freedom. And I didn't really even know where it came from, but I had submitted to the Utah Film Festival. I had checked that box and paid for that review. And it ended up being a fantastic review. And I was able to use that for other things. And then I was able to find relationships with people once I got in that film space and asked them to write a review. Lindsay Dunn, she came on as a critic. She lives in North Carolina. She did review the film. That was helpful. Again, you can use it on social media. And it's a very, very helpful tool. Now, sometimes they can be hard to read because every critic has their own point of view, but I find them all to be helpful in terms of you can learn what you need to change for next time. But reviews are important, and I think filmmakers ought to think about them, and they ought to figure out ways to make sure that their film is reviewed. It's not easy, but it can be done.
Yes, and I would say, too, it also it's really important that you know the audience of the film festival that you might want to submit your movie to. I'm going to use a big studio example, but earlier this year, the new Indiana Jones movie premiered at Cannes like a month before it came out, and it didn't go over very well. Like the audience, the Cannes audience and viewership did not enjoy the movie. And a lot of people have since said, well, maybe Cannes wasn't the right place. Maybe that's not, those aren't the people that enjoy an Indiana Jones movie. And so kind of thinking about where you're going to put your movie and the kind of people that might attend those festivals, that can be helpful too, just to think about
that, knowing your audience. Word of advice. Let me ask you this. Can you receive requests just like I requested you to review The Girl Who Wore Freedom? Could filmmakers listening to this podcast reach out to you and ask you to review their film?
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes I get that. So I'll get emails from maybe a publicity person saying, hey, there's a screening of this movie in Seattle or wherever. And the filmmaker will be there. You know, you can, would you like to come and see a free screening of the movie and then kind of, and then you can review it if you'd like. So that is something that definitely happens. I would say a lot of people that review things actually have just their own websites. So there's a lot of competition in big, like bigger sites for who's going to review what. And so a lot of people, especially freelancers, will then like start their own. And I hesitate to say blog because blog has kind of a certain connotation, but they'll start their own movie review website or maybe blog or column or whatever you want to call it. And that's where they will review what they want to review. So that could be a documentary, that could be a TV show, a you know, narrative film, fiction film, whatever it is. And so that's a great way for somebody who doesn't have, who can't find maybe regular work on the big sites to be able to still practice that writing. And so I would say, and writing about as much as you can and seeing as much as you can, I think is important to, for your own, you know, developing your own tastes and also, knowing what is out there is really important.
So how can people find you if they are interested in having you watch and review their film?
Yeah. So I am on Twitter, at Josh_Sharp22, is my username. I'm also on Threads and Instagram as well. And I also have a website, which is josh-sharp.com. And that's kind of where I've started just recently. I have a column there called, I call it Sharp Scribblings. And that's where I will write about things that are going on either like in the film world, like just observations I'm making or things that I notice, or I'll review something specifically, or maybe I'll talk about a movie that is an old movie that I like. So I've kind of done, I've done a mix of those things. But that's where people can find me.
Awesome. All right. I have one other question. And then Jason, I'm going to ask you afterwards if you've got any, so get your questions ready. Here's my last question. So I'd like you to talk about the film criticism as a field and how it's changed and evolved as technology has changed and evolved.
There's so much to talk about with this one, because like you said, you know, there was kind of an era of like Siskel and Ebert, right, where you have those two guys that had the thumbs up or thumbs down system, where they'd come on and they would sort of debate, and there was that fun banter, and you could watch that on TV, and then you'd kind of know what to go see based on that. And Leonard Maltin obviously falls in that too. And then as the internet came out, you have people that are starting like film websites where they write about film, and now so many people, I mean, like the app Letterboxd, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but
no,
it's a movie social media review app where you can go. And this is like, I love this stuff because I like making lists and I like keeping track of what I've seen, but you can go and you can like log every movie you see, give it a rating, and write a review if you want, or you can add it to like, you can have a watch later list or whatever. And, that's become a way where almost anybody can talk about film on the internet that wants to, and that's and you can meet other people that have similar tastes or not, and it's a really great way of seeing the movies that are out there, because there's so many, obviously, you know, great classic movies or movies that are independent films that are not publicized widely, and so seeing all of that is really great to have just in that app. I use it all the time.
So it's called Letterboxd.
Yep.
Without, it's like, I think it's Letterboxd. There's no ED. It's
yeah.
It had, okay. They had to make it a little bit complicated to find because, you know, the internet and apps and stuff now. They're like, oh, it can't just be spelled normal.
So is it like a social media app in a sense, but it's also a personal app to keep track of your own stuff?
So yes. Christian, I just pulled up mine. Like, I can keep track of my favorite movies, my recent activity, movies I've watched, that sort of thing. I can go through and rate them. I can write reviews, and then I can see what my friends are watching, which Josh, I don't know if I follow you on Letterboxd. We'll have to figure that out.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's like, you can see, you know, my friend just saw Iron Claw or, Men, or, you know, you can just see what people are watching, Poor Things. And you can see if they wrote a review, how much they liked it, whether or not they've rewatched it. So it's just a cool little way to keep track of what
you
see and what you like.
Another social media app for us to keep up with. But it sounds like a fun one.
It's really fun.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's a big one for writing about movies, I guess, and engaging with other people. I would say another really big way in which film criticism has changed is TikTok. Or movie talk is what they call it. There was an article in the New York Times about this a couple months ago that was really fascinating, and I wrote it down so I could remember, but it's called They Review Movies on TikTok But Don't Call Them Critics. And it's all about younger people kind of trying to reclaim this idea of what a film critic does. And most of these people don't do this for a living, or at least they didn't start doing this as a living. They had it maybe a day job, and then they'd go on TikTok and be like, hey, I went and saw this movie and it's great because, or whatever. And so that's become a really popular way of getting kind of different people's voices out there in a really digestible way, right? Because TikToks are quick and you can just say, okay, what does this person think? And that's been, it's interesting to see how that has gone that direction. I think there's a fine line there because, well, there's critics and then there's influencers. Influencers oftentimes will be sent things or be invited to maybe being even paid to promote a product like a movie. And I think that can get a little iffy when you're thinking about, okay, I want to give an objective review of something, which is different than, you know, I've been invited to the screening and I've been paid to promote their movie. it's a little muddy. So, or yeah, candy,
not very genuine.
Yeah, exactly.
Or trustworthy. And I think,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well, are you on TikTok?
Not in that way. I mean, I've used it a little bit, but not.
Oh, what way are you on TikTok?
No, like I do the doom scrolling sometimes, which is a bummer, but like I'm not posting reviews or anything on there. It's not necessarily. Yeah. I enjoy writing a lot. Like I feel like I'm a strong writer. So that's kind of where I try and put my attention.
Well, I will add one other, new technology twist on the movie review, and that is podcasting. So, and we have a resident podcaster here who for a while was on a movie review podcast called The Movie Proposal. And I'll let you talk about that a little bit, Jason, sort of the formula and what that was like. I'm mentioning it because I am going to be on the next upcoming Movie Proposal podcast. So it's fun for people to go and listen to that. We reviewed the movie Wonka, which I don't know if you've seen it yet or not, but I would love to hear a little bit about that. So Jason, talk to us about this podcasting movie review tool.
Yeah. So the Movie Proposal, it's a podcast where they go through and review, movies, and they do something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. So they talk about an old movie, a new movie, and then a borrowed article or something about that new movie, and then talk about something that they liked or didn't like, that was unrelated. I'm excited to hear that you're going on there. The podcasting space is a fascinating sort of place because, you know, podcasts can be like, you have no idea when you go on a podcast, if they have 12 listeners or 12,000. And it can be very hard to gauge that based on social, because a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I listen to that podcast, but I don't follow anybody on social. I don't follow anything about it. You know, it's just, I listen to that podcast. I really like what they do, but I don't interact in any way besides that. And so it can be really hard to gauge, you know, as a filmmaker or anyone going on a podcast, whether or not that podcast is in any way successful, or if you're basically talking to that person and their mom who listens.
Right. And also you don't really know how much of a level of, you know, knowledge they have in the film space either, unless you listen to them over and over again. Now the Movie Proposal, when it was, you know, it's with Josh Lindsay, who actually used to be a host here on Documentary First, Sky Jatani. And, you know, for a while it was with you, Jason, as well. You guys had a pretty high level of movie knowledge and filmmaking knowledge. But you know, there's no knowing if everybody does. So you really got to try it out, I think, and look for the reputation of the thing. So just another way that technology has changed the movie review process, I think. It's a big
deal. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And like I said earlier, like Leonard Maltin used to write, keep going back to Leonard Maltin, but Leonard Maltin used to write, you know, his books, and then those kind of, as the internet became a thing and much, much bigger, he stopped coming out with them every year. And so he's also adapted to times. Now he runs a kind of his own website and he writes reviews, movies there. And he has his podcast. So I think adjusting to, all of that is good because it's changed so much.
Yeah. All right, Jason, got any questions for Josh here?
Yeah, Josh, I'm really excited to have you on here, and you know, we've gotten to chat a few times, and I'm just excited to see where your career's going, that sort of thing. And so kind of what I want to talk about is, I think one of the ways we make things happen in our lives is to actually say where we want them to go. And so like, I would love to know from you, like in 5 years, what do you want to be doing? Where do you want to be headed with your career, reviews, that sort of thing? And you know, putting it out in the universe can sometimes help those things happen. So what in 5 years, where would you love to be with what you're doing?
Well, thanks for that question, Jason. I would say I really, you know, freelancing can be a hard way to exist. Like if you're trying to pitch something to a website all the time about something, and then you, maybe that doesn't work out, so you pitch it to another site, and that isn't always sustainable as your full-time job. You can certainly do it on the side or whatever. And you can do it full-time, but it's really difficult. I would say to keep busy all the time because there's so many people writing about film or wanting to write about film that you have a lot of competitors. And not that I don't think about other journalists as competitors, but there's a lot of people trying to, you know, write reviews for things and be published on sites that are being, first of all, that are actually pay, and also that are have a you know, solid readership. And so for me, in 5 years, I'd love to have kind of a sort of stable column or some place where I can write consistently, and maybe just one website, whatever that looks like, where I, you know, that my job is to write about film or write about the film business or just the industry in general, or review things, whatever that looks like. I'm not quite sure yet, but having that kind of stable spot where I can do that consistently at one place is really, I think, really valuable and something that I would really love to do within the next 5 years.
Awesome.
Well, anyone listening, if you've liked listening to Josh talk and you know anybody anywhere who would love to hear his thoughts and get him, you know, published in some more places, we would love to see that happen. So,
thanks, Jason.
If they can do that, where should they reach out to you if anyone wants to get in touch with you? Is it social media? We mentioned your Twitter/X handle, that sort of thing. Is that the best place
yes.
to reach you?
Yeah, and I also just yesterday changed my letterbox handle to match my Twitter handle so that they're all so that's the same. And also I think Instagram and everything. So yes, it's Josh_Sharp22 is what it is. Yeah. And then my website, where I write too. That's a place you can read things, my scribblings and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And just a practical question. Do filmmakers need to pay for their reviews? I'm sure there is a spectrum here of, like, I paid for at the Utah Film Festival. I'm sure the films at Telluride and, you know, Toronto and Sundance don't have to pay for their reviews. What do you have to say about that?
I think it does depend, like you were saying. I think a lot of times the people that are going to pay you for the review are going to be the site you write for. Like, if you're going to a film festival and you're seeing several things, and then Deadline, for example, is going to cover you know, is going to publish like three or four of your pieces about the things that you've seen. Deadline's going to be the one paying you, not the filmmaker that of whose film you just saw. But I think, yeah, like in your experience being, trying to get that word of mouth out there and getting people to see your film. I think that does happen, obviously, where people, where you have to pay to then request it, review, and then somebody, yeah, will review it from that point.
Beautiful. Well, this has been amazing to have you on. Thank you so much for this incredible information.
We really
appreciate it. Hopefully we'll have you back. It is now time for everybody's favorite section of the Documentary First podcast. We are now moving into DocuView Deja Vu. DocuView Deja Vu. All right, Josh, I'm going to let you go first. What do you got for us today?
Awesome. Well, I have a unique one that's about musical theater, but you don't have to like musical theater or Broadway to necessarily enjoy this documentary, I don't think. It's called Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened. And it's about the 1981 Broadway production of a musical called Merrily We Roll Along, which was written by Stephen Sondheim, who did
Sweeney Todd. Yeah, it's a famous musical.
It is a famous musical, but it only ran for 16 performances because the reviews were brutal. And so the show, the way the show works, if you're not familiar, is it's about a three creatives. So one of them is a playwright and writes scripts. And then another one's a director, and then another one is also a writer. And so the three of them, kind of their journey, but the way it works is it starts at the end of their career, kind of, or as they're older and sort of jaded and bitter. And with each scene, it moves backwards in time. And then the end is the beginning where they're young and excited about the world and kind of naive. And the way that it was casted originally is that the three leads and most of the cast actually were played by like teenagers. And that was not convincing for a lot of the audience. So one of those teenagers was a man named Lonnie Price, well, a kid named Lonnie Price, now an adult, obviously. And he went back and made this documentary film, reuniting all of these former child actors, now adults, seeing where they ended up in their lives and how that kind of big monumental experience as
failure.
Kids. Failure, but how it kind of like affected them for the rest of their life. And it's a really great documentary. I think it's a good time to watch it because right now on Broadway, there is a revival of Merrily We Row Along with Daniel Radcliffe of Harry Potter and John Groff and Lindsay Mendez. And it is like such a hit. It's making so much. It's like breaking like records. So first revival of this show is now a huge hit. So it's interesting to go back and look
at New York. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Okay. So where can we watch that? Do you know?
Yeah, for a bit there, it wasn't available. It was, and then it wasn't. And now you can see it. I think it's on Amazon Prime, Apple TV. You can rent it on all the usual places now. It was on Netflix for a long time, but I don't think it's there anymore.
Excellent. All right. Thank you for sharing that. All right, Jason, what do you got for us today?
So mine isn't a documentary, but it's a fascinating thing for people who love film or filmmakers in general. Variety just did a directors on directors piece with Greta Gerwig and James Cameron. Mm. And it is so good. It is so interesting to hear these two incredibly visionary directors who are kind of at the opposite ends of their careers. You know, you have Greta Gerwig, who's only on her third movie, and James Cameron, who, I mean, he's been a prolific director since the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So you have these two people talking about their struggles and the things they've learned from each other. Cause James Cameron is not shy about what he's learned from Greta's filmography and vice versa. And so it's a very cool interview. It's also, they're both writer directors. So they talk about the relationship of being a writer, and then you get to set and everyone's looking at you and going, what do we do? What do we do? And you go back, you fall back to the document that you wrote and you use that as like, well, it says here that we're supposed to do this, so we're going to do that, you know, that sort of thing. And they also talk a lot about adapting films. Like one thing James Cameron talks about is when they're shooting True Lies, they they had this whole huge sequence on a mountain with a helicopter, and the helicopter crashes and there's this huge shootout and all this sort of stuff. And they got up there, they shot one day, and he goes, we're going to be up here for a month if we keep shooting like this. And he just goes, we're going to miss our release window. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to cut the helicopter. He's going to shoot two guys, get in a van and drive off. And that's what made it into the movie. And so it's just so cool to hear these people talking about how, you know, one thing to talk about is like, you have your script, and every day after that, it feels like you're chipping away pieces of it and losing things that you wanted. And you finally wind up in the editing room, and that's when you can start putting everything back together and actually seeing how does it work. Yeah. And I just think it's so interesting to listen to their process, so interesting to listen to these little anecdotes and stories they have about who they are, how they feel when they're on set, and everybody's looking at you and you're burning thousands of dollars a minute because you have 20, 30, 40, 50 people looking at you and everything. So yeah, it's really good, and also just humanizes directors a lot. You know, these top tier people, makes it really accessible. So highly recommend.
Awesome. And so is this a video or audio thing?
It's a video. You could pretty much just treat it like a podcast. It's 42 minutes, just them sitting and talking. But they do show the occasional little clip or that sort of thing, but it's primarily just them talking.
And where do we find this?
It's on YouTube.
All right.
Variety YouTube channel.
And we'll put that link in the show notes for sure. All right. Since I am sort of the boss around here, I'm going to change our DocuView Deja Vu rule. And I'm going to talk about something that's not a documentary because it is really sticking in my craw, shall we say. This is a film that I watched last week that just will not leave me. Flo Plana, who I've talked about several times now on this film, came to visit me last week. He's, you know, a Frenchman from France who is in The Girl Who Wore Freedom. And he sat down on my couch and saw, decided he wanted to watch a movie and saw Leave the World Behind and said, oh, I'm dying to see that. I knew nothing about it. I was like, okay, he's a guest. We'll watch what he wants to watch. And I didn't know what it was. So I started watching it. It had Julia Roberts and Mark Ruffalo. And I thought, oh, this will be fantastic. And you know, it started off absolutely delightful and so fun. And you know, they were going on vacation, spur of the moment. Julia Roberts' characters had rented this VRBO, and they were you know, living in New York. They were going to go out to Long Island. It's a place I was familiar with. I was so excited for this. And then they get to their you know, Airbnb or whatever, and all of a sudden, everything starts to change. And so the log line for this film is a family's getaway to a luxurious rental home takes an ominous turn when a cyber attack knocks out their devices and two strangers appear at the door. So this film, I started to feel like it was going to be this horror film. It's not a horror film. It's listed as a drama and a mystery. And it is a mystery for sure. And I would kind of say it's almost a thriller. So I highly recommend it. The ending sort of caught me cold. I was like, is that the end? But as I walked away from the film and I started to think about it, I thought it was a beautiful ending. And really, it's kind of hopeful at the end. So highly recommend it. And it's a super fun watch. You can find it on Netflix, obviously. So that's my recommendation. The only other question I have is I also watched Wonka this weekend. And I'm wondering, Josh, how many thumbs up do you give it?
I would give it 1.5 thumbs up out of 2. I liked it a lot.
You liked it a lot.
Agreeing to.
On the movie proposal, you have to come with a proposal. And so I proposed that this movie was for a younger audience. I'm 57. I did enjoy it, but I did feel like it was made for a younger demographic. And if you want to hear more of my thoughts, go listen to the Movie Proposal podcast that covers the Wonka film. So awesome. There you go. Yeah.
The only thing I want to say about Wonka is I really enjoyed it. And I could feel the eventual stage play watching the film.
Yes. What does that mean?
I could feel like what it's going to look like on stage.
Oh, I when see they what you're saying.
The inevitable day it becomes a Broadway musical.
Yeah, or you know, youth theaters start doing it and schools and everybody starts doing their Wonka version. It was so constructed. It's kind of so rhythmically constructed that I could see it on stage while watching the movie.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And the thing that's interesting, and for those of you that don't know about Wonka, it really is the prequel to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It was a book written by Ronald Dahl. It originally then was adapted to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in 1971, a movie that I grew up with and loved. And so this film is about how Wonka became Wonka. And I do think that you're right. This is absolutely going to be a musical one day on Broadway that will probably be a hit and trickle down to your middle school. So good call there, Jason. It's a fun watch for sure. Feast for the eyes. You know, I'd love for people to go and see it, see what they think. All right. Well, we've covered a huge swath of things. We've gone a little bit over time, but it has been a delight talking to you, Josh. We look forward to getting to know you better. Thank you for being in our Patreon community. If you guys would like to get to know Josh, please reach out to him on all of his various and sundry social media places or his website, or join us on Patreon and talk to him in our little Patreon chat. Come and be part of the magic that we're putting together for 2024. So, all right, Jason,
Thank you so much, Christian.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Josh, for being here. And thank you all for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everyone has a story to tell and you can be the one to tell it.
Yes, you can. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. Or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.